This is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. For as long as there's been an ocean, there have been tides. Twice a day, every day. By now, you'd think we have a pretty good scientific handle on tides. And we do. But there are still plenty of questions, even mysteries, as Jonathan White found out firsthand. He lays it all out in his new book, Tides, The Science and Spirit of the Ocean. And he joins me now via Skype. Jonathan, welcome to Living Lab.
Oh, thank you for having me.
You grew up in California, surfing, fishing, boating, all of that, right on the ocean. What was it about tides out of all the aspects of the ocean that drew your curiosity?
Well, it's interesting because I wouldn't say necessarily that I was drawn to tides initially. I mean, I lived by the tides, like a lot of people do on the coast. I always had a tide chart in my back pocket, it seems, and I referred to them in terms of when to go surfing or diving or sailing or whatever. But it really wasn't until I almost lost a big old wooden schooner that I owned up in Southeast Alaska that I suddenly decided that it was time to learn how the tides worked.
Nothing like almost losing your boat to spark your curiosity.
That's right. I had this big old schooner, and we had a nonprofit educational organization on the boat and ran seminars up and down the coast from Seattle to Alaska. So I had a group of paying passengers on board and went aground in a huge gale and huge tide in Alaska, and the boat was completely flooded. And after that experience, I thought, okay, we've got to learn what's going on with the tide here.
You mentioned the fact that, you always had your tide chart and lived by your tide chart when you lived in California. And to some degree, that's been true for coastal communities for thousands of years, right? You have to understand when the water will be up and down in order to survive along the coast. And if you look just, watching it, you can get the basics of the tides, that there's going to be a high and a low twice a day, that follows the cycle of the moon. How did communities, if we go back 5 or 10,000 years ago, how did people explain the tides?
Oh, that's a great question. There's not a good written record of it. But as you say, for sure, our ancestors who settled along the coasts understood a very good practical understanding between the moon and the sun and the tides. I mean, that's inevitable. And in a lot of ways, they counted on that for survival. But they didn't know how it worked. They didn't know the mechanism. In fact, we didn't get even the very beginning pieces of that mechanism until Newton and his colleagues at the end of the scientific revolution in 1700s. So, but for all those years, of course, there was a lot of speculation about what was going on. And some people thought that the moon did it by heating rocks on the bottom of the ocean. And as those rocks heated, the waters boiled and expanded, and that was high tide. And then when the moon went away, those rocks cooled and the water contracted as they cooled, and that was low tide. And some people thought it was the breathing of the earth, or even the breathing of a large monster. In fact, Leonardo da Vinci was convinced it was the breathing of a large beast, and he tried to calculate the size of its lung. So there was a lot of mythology around the tides before we got some scientific foothold to understand what was going on.
Reading your book, I was thinking back to being taught about tides in school, and I'm pretty sure it was a pretty perfunctory coverage of the topic. You have the gravitational pull of the sun and the moon, and you get tides. And by the end of your book, I'm thinking to myself, what was he thinking? This is so complicated.
Yeah, really.
I mean, did you ever question yourself as you're writing this book? You mentioned that one leading tide modeler and oceanographer that you talked to, you asked him about aha moments, and he says, I don't have aha moments. I only have oh crap moments when I realize I've forgotten something. I mean, did you ever question your own sanity trying to write this book?
Absolutely. It feels like every hour, every day. I had no idea what I was getting into. And, I thought when I came out of that Alaskan experience, I thought, okay, I'll read a book or two or an article or two, take a couple of weeks and learn everything there was to know about the tide. But I was so wrong. The more I read, the more interesting and multi-leveled and complex and poetic it became. And so, you know, two books quickly turned into 50, and then 300, and a couple of weeks turned into 10 years before I knew it. And so, yes, absolutely. I was always wondering, just how deep am I going to go into this thing?
Well, your research turned up all sorts of stories that I certainly had never heard. I mean, you mention just kind of briefly early in the book that Aristotle, by some accounts, was so frustrated by trying to understand the tides and the currents near his home that he eventually flung himself into the ocean saying, "Comprehend me, since I cannot comprehend thee." Is that really true?
Well, it's a rumor, but it's interesting because that rumor has persisted a long time. And in fact, there are different stories about it. But, you know, the main thing about it is it shows how, is that really, you know, great thinkers have tried to tackle this problem. They've been intrigued by it. They've tried to figure it out. And B, is it's really hard to understand all of it. And Aristotle, it's interesting with Aristotle because he was in the Mediterranean, of course, and the Mediterranean doesn't have large tides. I mean, they have tides of a few inches, except in different places. But the subject was interesting enough to Aristotle and others, people of his time, that they tried to understand what was going on. And in fact, even later, much later, after Newton, Laplace, who's considered the French Newton, said the tides is the stickiest problem in astronomy. So it's it persists, and we know, of course, a lot more about the tides than we ever did, and certainly a lot more has developed since Newton's time. But we still don't know everything. There's still some mysteries about it.
You're listening to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking with Jonathan White, author of Tides, The Science and Spirit of the Ocean. Now, Jonathan, it wasn't just Aristotle. You go through a who's who of early physicists, from Copernicus to Kepler, and in fact say that tides were central to Galileo's argument that the Earth revolves around the sun rather than vice versa. How so?
Well, Galileo, you know, of course, as you say, you know, his main point was to prove that the Earth is not the center of the universe, and that the Earth is not stationary. So his thinking went that, well, if the tides are sloshing around the Earth, then it must be an indication that the Earth is moving. So he used that really as a theory to show that the Earth is moving. He wasn't so interested in the tides, and in fact, he left the moon out of his theory completely. So in the book, in fact, that got him into trouble with the church, he talks about how the sloshing of the tides is evidence that the Earth is moving. And in fact, that book was first called The Flux and Influx of the Sea. And Pope talked him out of that title. But that it really was a book about tides that got him excommunicated.
Wow. Well, then fast forward to Newton. You say that was kind of the final nail in the coffin for Aristotelian cosmology, because, of course, we get the theory of gravity. And that made a huge, if not hugely controversial, impact on our understanding of the tides. But how big a part of Newton's work were the tides? Was this just, you know, one side effect of his theory of gravity? Or, like Galileo, was this a really central part of his thinking?
Well, in Newton's book, The Principia, that came out in, I think, 1668 or something like that, there are three pages of this huge book that are dedicated to the tides. So it's a very, very small part of his thinking. And in fact, you know, there's good evidence that Newton never saw the ocean, that he traveled within the inside of England, but never saw the ocean. Yet his theory of gravity and tides was so profound. I mean, it still exists today. It's called the equilibrium theory. And although it's wrong in a lot of ways, it's also right in certain ways. And it is a fundamental theory on which we still look at the tides.
Well, Newton considered this basic case that is probably what I'm remembering being taught in school, that was that perfunctory treatment, which is if you had a planet with no continents and an ocean of, flat bottom, equal depth, what would the tides look like? And what's the answer that he got?
Well, the answer that he got is that basically it's again called the equilibrium theory, which is basically that the water is bulged up around the moon or other forces, and it's always trying to reach equilibrium, but it never reaches it. So there's a bulge underneath the moon, and then there's also a bulge of water, that is. And then there's also a bulge on the opposite side of the Earth from where the moon is. And that bulge is caused by centrifugal force, which is it's a Greek word meaning to flee. And that's the same kind of force we feel when we turn, when we're driving and we come around a turn, we're driving a little too fast and it wants to spin us out. Or if we spin a water balloon and that stretches out. So so there's a bulge underneath the moon, there's a bulge on the opposite side of the moon, and then we turn underneath that. So imagine yourself in Cape Cod underneath a full moon and it's high tide. And then 12 hours from that point, you're on the opposite side of the Earth and you're underneath the other bulge, another high tide. And in between those points, you're in a low tide. So in other words, you start high tide and you go to a low tide 6 hours later, and then you go to the opposite bulge on the opposite side of the Earth, high tide, and then another low tide as you travel through the valley, and then finally you make the full 24 hours and you're back at high tide again.
But of course, in that model, you end up with two perfectly equal high tides that are exactly, you know, a 24-hour day. And we know that's not how tides work, right? One tide of the day is usually higher, is bigger than the other high tide. And it's not a perfect 24-hour schedule. It's constantly shifting by a little bit each day. So where do those kind of oddities in the tide cycle come from?
Well, for many, many years, and even today, that there's been an effort to find these general rules that apply to tides everywhere. And there are general rules, which I just described, and Newton's equilibrium theory is a general rule. But there are so many exceptions to those general rules that it's almost an oxymoron. So, yes, you're right. There are places in the world that have one tide a day, and there are places in the world that have four tides a day. And there are all kinds of other tides, tide anomalies in between. So what accounts for some of that is that, like, for example, you say that typically we don't have two perfectly or the same high tides every day. And that's because the Earth is tilted to the sun. So we don't actually travel through the largest part of that bulge on both of those, both sides of the Earth. We might travel through the peak of the bulge underneath the moon, and then as we travel around that 24-hour cycle, we travel through the edge of the other bulge. So that would account for a high tide and then a lower high tide. That's why we have different heights of tides each day.
You're talking about, you know, this combination of feeling the sun, feeling the moon. There's also local topography, all these things. I mean, because we've been talking about basically what the tide would be like on a planet with no continents. And of course, we do have continents and have even mountains and different depths under the ocean. Why do different places feel the tides so differently?
The study of tides can be divided up into two categories pretty easily. One would be what's happening up there, which is astronomy, and that's the various relationships between the Earth, Moon, and Sun. And then the other part would be what's happening down here, what's called fluid dynamics. And then you could even divide the fluid dynamic part into two. And one of them would be what's happening in the deep ocean, and then what's happening in the shallow waters of the coast. In the deep ocean, the tide is generally about 18 inches all everywhere. And 12 of those inches is attributable to the moon, and 6 inches is attributable to the sun. And then when that tide, that 18-inch tide or whatever, crosses the continental shelf and starts to really feel the bottom, the shallow water, as you say, and the further it gets into the coast, it bumps into continents, it drags on the bottom, it reflects, it refracts, it folds back on itself, it stands, it interferes with other tides. It gets amazingly complex. And this is where you get into that complexity that befuddled Aristotle and Laplace and that tide modeler that you talked about in the Bay of Fundy, where the tide just doesn't do what you expect it to do everywhere.
Tides have often been part of cultures' spiritual beliefs. There are still festivals to watch some of the most extreme tides in the world. Do you think it's just that complexity that inspires that kind of spiritual connection to the tides, or do you think there's something else there?
Well, I think it might be the complexity, but I think it's more about that this is this large body of water that most of us live near, right? 75 or 80% of the population in the world lives close to the ocean in one way or another. And many of those people work on the ocean or have history of people who live and work on the water, fishing, diving, or whatever. And so I think that this is just our fascination for it is part of our long-term relationship with this huge body of water that's right at our doorstep.
We may not understand everything about what's driving the tides, but we can do a pretty good job at this point of predicting how high the tide or how low the tide will be at a given place, in some cases for hundreds of years into the future. And in some ways that makes it an ideal source of renewable energy, right? You know exactly how much tidal energy you could produce at any given time, as opposed to the wind or the sun, where, you know, we're working on a day or two forecast maybe for those kinds of things. What do you think is holding back our use of tides as a renewable energy source?
Well, I think part of it is that we don't have a unified policy in the United States to support this. We never have, and it doesn't look like in the current administration we're going to get that. But other countries do have that, like Germany and Scotland and even Australia. So I think that's part of the problem here in the United States. Yet, you know, we do have devices in the water that are producing electricity here in the States. We have longstanding devices in New York, on the Hudson River, and up in Maine and parts of Washington State, and even California down in the Bay Area. They don't have devices in the water yet, but they're looking at it. So I think that, you know, policy is one issue. The technology is another. The ocean is a very hostile environment. And while there's a huge amount of energy there to harness, and I think we will, I think that tide energy, as you say, it's dependable, it's reliable. I don't think it's a silver bullet that's going to solve our renewable energy need, but I think it's a part of that puzzle. So one story that I like to tell that demonstrates where we are with this is there's a testing site in the Bay of Fundy called Force, and the first device went underneath the water there about 8 years ago, and it looked like a big propeller or a big windmill with a 60-foot wingspan, and it went down, and it was completely crumpled in about 2 weeks' time, and it came up, and it, you know, and the publicity people said, well, the good news about that is there's a lot more power down there than we thought. Yeah, and the bad news is that we have a long ways to go to develop these devices so they're strong enough to withstand those kinds of forces.
Jonathan White is author of Tides, The Science and Spirit of the Ocean. Jonathan, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Heather. Appreciate you having me.
Living Lab Radio continues with a look at a mathematical approach to health, wealth, and even a happy marriage. That's coming up after a short break.